People who don't know Bruce have to understand two things. One is he's built like something Michelangelo has carved out of a piece of marble.
True, this is true.
And number two, he's the first person to show you that at every party, at every dinner.
Maybe take a shirt off.
I'm Bruce Bozzi. That was George and Julia. You may not know me yet, but you already know most of my lunch dates by their first names and voices alone. Listen to Table for Two on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marcellus Wiley, that dude, and host of More To It, a new iHeart original podcast that takes a deep dive into the biggest stories in sports, entertainment, and culture. We start with headline news and journey into deeper conversations, always finding those life lessons that are presented in every single story. Did you know why football is a great game of skill, but a greater game of will? You'll know when you listen to More To It on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your favorite shows.
Where were you in 92? Bouncing your butt to Sir Mix-a-Lot? Wondering if you, like Billy Ray Cyrus, could pull off a mullet? Now iHeart has a podcast all about it. I'm Jason Lanfear, and on my new show, Where Were You in 92, we take a ride through the major hits, one-hit wonders, and shocking scandals that shaped the wildest 12 months in music history.
You know, the president came after me. Everybody, Time Warner, was madness.
Music was magic, and I had completely burned that to the ground.
I realized I'm the forbidden fruit.
So listen and follow Where Were You in 92 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
In October of 2005, 19-year-old Brandon Woodruff was home from college visiting his parents. They had just moved to a new home in Roy City, Texas. Brandon helped them around the house, and then the family sat down to a pizza dinner. In almost every way, it was a normal Sunday night for the Woodruffs.
Everything just seemed to be ordinary. I mean, if somebody were to tell me, well, it was there one thing that was strange, was there one thing that was odd, and I can't pinpoint anything. It was just a normal weekend. None of this, what ended up happening was even, I mean, I couldn't even have thought that would have happened.
2 days later, Brandon's parents were found brutally murdered. In the days that followed, Brandon was doing his best to try and help investigators find out who had killed them.
And then they just flipped the whole table and they were like, well, we really think that you murdered your parents. My name is Brandon Del Woodruff. I'm 36 years old. I'm from Rockwall, Texas, and I've been wrongly convicted for 17 years.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Brandon Woodruff. Brandon Woodruff was born September 6, 1986, in Rockwall, Texas, to Dennis and Norma Woodruff. Brandon and his sister, Charla, are 18 months apart.
He was a baby of the family.
This is Brandon's grandma, Bonnie.
Brandon was always a happy child. He loved everyone. He was always happy, singing when he was a little boy, smiling.
Brandon describes life growing up as idyllic.
We had two wonderful parents. They kind of spoiled us a whole lot.
He says the family was always on the go and participating in community events. Charla was a dancer and had recitals and shows, and Brandon embraced the country life. The Woodruffs lived on a farm in the town of Heath, just a few miles south of Rockwall.
Kind of a small town. It's really close-knit.
And Brandon was involved in the youth agricultural organizations 4-H and Future Farmers of America.
My mom gave me this passion for horses, and so my mom was really there to, you know, kind of inspire me and teach me things with the horses, with the cattle. Like, she was a blue jean kind of woman. Most moms like cook. Well, my dad cooked, and my mom was out there hauling hay, like a hardworking guy. And, you know, she would go out there with a post hole digger and, you know, go dig to put a post and build a fence. Yeah, she was definitely like one of the strongest women I've known.
Brandon says he and his mom raised livestock to show and sell at markets in the surrounding cities.
We would basically get a young cow and you basically raise them up since a baby. You halter train them, which can be hectic. And then I didn't really want to do the market steers because then you would have to sell them to butcher, and I really didn't want to butcher my animals.
So Brandon would show them instead, traveling to fairs all over Texas.
So it's a lot of hours and 3 o'clock morning drive times to Waco, Texas, and Abilene, and Fort Worth Stock Show, and all different types of rodeo and fairs. So
that is a life I know nothing about, but it sounds pretty cool.
Brandon loved this life, especially being around horses.
Really, I kind of wanted to be a horse trainer. Like, I really have this huge horse bug. My mom volunteered at a therapeutic riding center called EQuest. It's for like disabled kids and kids with like autism and stuff. And so she used to take me out there to volunteer. You know, it kind of opened my eyes to the world is a little bit different than in your perfect little neighborhoods.
Brandon was also really close with his father. He says his dad was really funny.
Like, he was kind of embarrassingly funny. Like, he was a class clown, like I was kind of. He would just make everybody laugh. And I would have friends come over, and he would blare Tina Turner's Proud Mary. Like, at 8 o'clock in the morning, he would go get donuts, and I would come out, and he would be in the room dancing to Proud Mary. And I've got my friends over, and I'd be like, Dad, are you crazy?
One time, Brandon remembers he broke both his legs falling off a horse. For the first 2 months of recovery, he was bedridden, and his dad was totally there for him.
And so I had a toilet next to my bed. And I remember when I had to use the toilet, it was so embarrassing for me. You know, I'm already a teenager, and I'm having to scoot onto this plastic toilet to use the bathroom. And my dad literally took off work so he could be there. So anytime that, like, I needed him, I could just say, hey, Dad, you know, and he would come in there and he would clean up the whole toilet, like no questions asked, no embarrassment, no belittlement.
Brandon says there was a lot of love in the Woodruff household. But internally, he was struggling. It started around his high school years in the early 2000s.
I basically started like maybe exploring my sexuality.
He had a girlfriend, Morgan, who he really loved. But he also had thoughts and feelings about boys.
Coming from a close-knit town, there wasn't too many quote-unquote gay kids at school. I think we maybe had like one or two. And, you know, as embarrassed I am to say it now, you know, I was kind of along with the group that kind of made fun of them.
So in his world of Rockwall, Texas, Brandon kept his attraction to boys to himself.
You know, to my friends that I showed cattle and horses with, I knew that they'd probably not understand. And especially the reaction to gay people in my small town, you know, they were just kind of like ostracized a little bit. Like I said, there was maybe only two in my public high school. And I think both of them went to alternative school by the end of their senior year because it just got too much. I mean, the people calling them names, stuff like that. I really didn't see any like of the LGBT community in my neighborhood. You know, we definitely didn't have no Pride Month. We definitely didn't have no Pride parades. We didn't have none of that. So I would actually have to drive into Dallas, which was about 35 minutes away, to go experience any of that stuff. What I would do is I'd kind of go out on the weekends. I'd visit like a gay club. I visited a couple of gay bars.
Brandon would also go online in chat rooms and MySpace groups for gay men. He says life went on like that for a while.
I thought my private world was going to be my private world. Probably like mid, late senior year in 2005, I really started getting to where I really kind of just didn't care. It wasn't like I was advertising my sexuality. I wasn't jumping up and down with a rainbow flag, but I wasn't hiding it as so much because I was going in public places. I was having, you know, boyfriends.
Then one night when Brandon was on his way out, his dad asked him the name of the club he was going to.
I really didn't want to tell him that it was a gay club, so I just said a club's name on the radio that we had heard, you know, like repeated over the years. And the next day he said, you know, that club you went to last night was a gay club. And inadvertently, I had given him a gay club's name anyway. And so I actually had to kind of tell him, well, okay, you know, I just told him I didn't know yet at that time.
Which was the truth. Brandon was still trying to find himself and figure it all out.
And he told me, you know, be safe, be careful. And he said, when you find out, let me know.
Dennis would be the type of person that would accept that, you know? I mean,
here's Brendan's grandma Bonnie again.
He was accepting of people because he loved people, just like Brendan, you know. Didn't matter who they were, because he had a friend that was also gay.
I've told my dad a lot worse. I could tell my dad anything. I could literally talk to my dad about the bad grades I was making. Now, sometimes I would try to hide them too, but at the end of the day, my dad's gonna be there for me, no matter what.
So were the bad grades worse than being gay? Is that one of the worst things you told him?
I mean, I really think that the bad grades would have been a little bit worse than being gay. Like, my parents were like so hands-on loving that's the last thing that they would have really even cared about.
Brendan graduated from Rockwall High School in 2005 and went on to Abilene Christian University, about 3.5 hours away. He found himself struggling in his first semester. He was put on academic probation and was on the verge of failing out of college. His parents told him they could no longer support him financially if that happened, and that he'd have to come back home. But Brendan wasn't worried about money. He would wear designer clothes, go on shopping sprees, and eat out often, which led his college friends to believe he came from a wealthy family. But the reality was Brendan was acting in pornographic movies to make money, though he told his friends he had taken up modeling. Most of his money was coming from making porn, but with his spending habits, he was racking up credit card debt. In October of that first semester in college, Brendan came home for a few days to see his parents and help them out. His parents had just bought a trailer home in Royce City, about 14 miles north. They still had some things at their place in Heath and needed help moving.
I guess it was like a foreclosed property. So there was a lot of stuff that my mom wanted to do to get the horses out there eventually. And so I was just home, you know, to help her and help my dad a little bit.
On the evening of October 16th, the Woodruff family sat down for a pizza dinner in their new place.
Everything just seemed to be ordinary. I mean, if somebody were to tell me, well, was there one thing that was strange? Was there one thing that was odd? And I can't pinpoint anything. It was just a normal weekend.
After the dinner, Brendan headed out for the evening. He plans on coming back to Roy City in a few days to take Father's Day pictures with his sister, Charla, who would also be home from school.
And so really, I was expecting to see them, you know, in 4 days. So what ended up happening was I couldn't even have thought that would have happened.
Shortly after 7 p.m. on October 16th, Brendan left his parents' home to go out with friends, first stopping by their old home in Heath, about 24 minutes away. A bit after 10 that night, a neighbor saw Brendan in the driveway of the Heath house. Then Brendan picked up some friends around 10:40 p.m. and went to Dallas to party with them and his boyfriend Alex. Brendan drove back to school in Abilene in the early hours the following morning. Later that day, on the 17th, people started becoming concerned about Dennis and Norma Woodruff. They didn't show up to work, which was unusual for them, and no one had seen or spoken to them since 9 p.m. the night before, when Norma talked with her mother on the phone. Charla had called her parents from school at 11 p.m. on Sunday night and had not heard back. So she contacted her Aunt Linda on the 18th, 2 days after they were last heard from. Linda reached out to a family friend to go over to the Woodruff's new home to check on them. A couple of friends showed up, knocked, and got no response. So they opened a window with a pry bar to see what was going on. Once inside, they found a horrific scene. Dennis and Norma's dead bodies were seated on their couch. They'd each been shot and stabbed several times. This episode is underwritten by AIG, a leading global insurance company. AIG is committed to corporate social responsibility and to making a positive difference in the lives of its employees and in the communities where they work and live. In light of the compelling need for pro bono legal assistance, and in recognition of AIG's commitment to criminal and social justice reform, The AIG Pro Bono program provides free legal services and other support to underrepresented communities and individuals. When investigators from the Hunt County Sheriff's Office arrived at the Woodruff's trailer home, they found a crime scene covered in blood. Yet they failed to wear protective foot coverings. And what's even more bizarre, they began investigating in the dark.
They think, well, this is how the murderers would have seen the house, so we're going to turn off the lights in the house, and that's how we're going to walk around and make our crime scene video. And during the course of doing that, you know, they're knocking stuff off, they're destroying all kinds of, you know, potential evidence of the scene. They literally investigated the crime in the dark.
This is Allison Clayton. She's the deputy director of the Innocence Project of Texas and the adjunct professor of the Innocence Clinic at Texas Tech University School of Law. Allison says that inside the trailer, it's unclear what had been disturbed by the crime or by the investigators stumbling around in the dark. But what seems clear is that there were strange items found laying around the house. Flavored condom packets were strewn about, along with an extensive pornography collection and an air mattress, completely inflated. On top of the mattress were two pairs of women's capri pants that were way too big to fit Norma. Brandon says none of this was there when he left on that Sunday night. Joel Gibson was the lead investigator on the case, along with Texas Ranger Jeff Collins. And Brandon was their lead suspect. He was the last person known to have seen his parents.
And they were like, well, we really think that you murdered your parents. And I didn't know what to think. You know, I wasn't raised to cuss at a law enforcement officer or anything. And I just kind of lost it because I thought, you do not know what you're talking about. Like, you don't know who these people are. These are my parents. These, like, are the people who raised me.
Brandon was devastated. His parents had been violently murdered, and here he was being accused of killing them. And what stung even more, his sister Charla turned on him. She told police she thought that Brandon could have done it.
I think my sister's sentence that had been repeated over and over, well, if he could lie about being gay, then he could lie about killing my parents.
On November 10th, 2005, Brandon was indicted for capital murder. His grandma Bonnie was horrified.
I knew Brandon couldn't have done anything to his parents. He loved both his parents. He said his dad was his best friend. So I know, you know, I'm even more convinced today. I know what type of person he is and what love he has for people and for God. So I know Brandon Woodruff.
As for the investigators,
I just think they were a small town, and they were a little bit lazy. They just wanted to wrap that case up because it makes the neighborhood feel better and safe.
They knew that Brandon was the last person to see them alive because, you know, they knew that he had gone and gotten the pizza.
This is Allison Clayton again.
And it's the fact that there was no forced entry into the house. So they thought that that indicated that it was somebody that the Woodruffs knew.
Allison says that investigators quickly homed in on Brandon, not only for those reasons, but also because the police had discovered his secret life.
So then that was a large part of their motive, that Brandon was leading this double life, that he was coming home and helping his parents move on the weekend and then going out and partying at gay nightclubs and, you know, participating in all these activities, and that they were about to find out and his grades were bad and he had credit card debt. And so, you know, they were about to cut him off. And so he was just terrified that he was going to get cut off. And so in an act of indescribable violence, the way these people were murdered was very, very violent. You know, he just decides to murder his parents.
Brandon's trial started on March 6th, 2009, in front of the Honorable Judge Richard Beacom Jr. The current governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, was the state's attorney general at the time, and he was appointed as a special prosecutor on the case. The state presented the theory that Brandon was living a double life, having money troubles and failing out of school, all of which he wanted to keep secret from his parents. But mainly,
really the state's only motive Brandon would have had to do this is that he was gay. That's it. He's gay. His parents are going to find out about it. and so he just has to kill them right now. And remember, again, this is small town Texas, early 2000s, uber, uber conservative. So the mention of, oh, well, he was gay would have been plenty to start raising eyebrows. Like, oh my goodness, he was gay. What a shame. Like, that's what would have been the sentimentality coming, someone coming from small town Texas in the early 2000s.
The state offered no real hard evidence against Brandon. It was mostly speculation.
I think they got caught up in this whole story of, well, he had a double life. He was wearing boots and jeans, and then he was wearing city clothes. And he was, you know, like, they felt like he was a lot more sinister when really it was just me being myself. I mean, I would wear boots and jeans when I was around the horses and stuff. And then I would wear, you know, what they would call like city clothes, I guess, to, you know, the bars and clubs and stuff. But your clothing doesn't make you who you are, and your clothing doesn't make you a killer. And you liking guys and girls, or just guys or just girls, it doesn't make you a killer either.
But there was one thing. Brandon's girlfriend Morgan's parents noticed that a Western-style revolver was missing from their home. They didn't know how long it had been missing, but they remembered that the night before the murder, Brandon had showered at their house, and so would have been able to take the revolver.
And so police were thinking that that, you know, had corroborated their suspicions of Brandon because he would have had the opportunity to steal the gun. They viewed that as inculpatory evidence, that he had the opportunity to get what they thought would be the murder weapon.
The gun used in the murders was never recovered, but the state offered expert testimony that the gun missing from Morgan's home could have theoretically been the one used to commit the murders. One of the main things the state focused on during trial was Brandon's cell phone records to try and disprove Brandon's alibi, that he was driving around, picking up friends, and heading to a club. However, because of a merger between cell phone companies, many of Brandon's calls during the crucial Sunday night time period were missing, and that didn't bode well for the defense. After both sides presented, the jury deliberated for 5 hours.
And, you know, it was just the whole time I kept telling myself, well, okay, everything's going to be okay. Everything is going to be. I never would have thought they were going to return a guilty verdict ever. Like, I really felt like I was going home that day.
But he didn't. Brandon was convicted by a jury of murdering his parents on March 20th, 2009.
So they said guilty. And I was like, I really just wanted to sit down. Like, I wanted to sit down. I wanted to, like, just breathe. I was really kind of freaking out.
But Brandon was told to remain standing while his sister, Charla, gave a victim impact statement.
Where my sister got up there and basically just told me how I ruined her whole life and told me how, you know, because of my actions. And that was the hardest thing to hear, because I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I did not do this. And I just had to stand there and be quiet and accept it. And I think that was the hardest thing in my entire life. And I will never forget that.
You had to sit there and listen to your sister not believe you. Like, what is that like? Like, this is the person you grew up with. She's supposed to know you better than anybody.
Yeah. And I, you know, it makes so many questions come up. Like, why? Like, why are you doing this? Like, I don't know. It's really hard to just grasp. I mean, even to this day, it's hard to grasp.
At 22 years old, Brandon was sentenced to life in prison without parole.
There is no need for the outside world because we are removed from it and apart from it and in our own universe.
On the new podcast, The Turning, Room of Mirrors, we look beneath the delicate veneer of American ballet and the culture formed by its most influential figure, George Balanchine.
There are not very many of us that actually grew up with Balanchine. It was like I grew up with Mozart.
He could do no wrong. Like, he was a god.
But what was the cost for the dancers who brought these ballets to life, where the lines between the professional and the personal were hazy and often crossed?
He used to say, "What are you looking at, dear? You can't see you, only I can see you."
most people in the ballet world are more interested in their experience of watching it than in the dancer's experience of executing it.
Listen to The Turning, Room of Mirrors on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Attention, Bachelor Nation. He's back. The man who hosted some of America's most dramatic TV moments returns with a brand new tell-all podcast. The most dramatic podcast ever with Chris Harrison.
It's going to be difficult at times. It'll be funny. We'll push the envelope. But I promise you this, we have a lot to talk about.
For two decades, Chris Harrison saw it all. And now he's sharing the things he can't unsee.
I'm looking forward to getting this off my shoulders and repairing this, moving forward, and letting everybody hear from me.
What does Chris Harrison have to say now? You're going to want to find out.
I have not spoken publicly for 2 years about this, and I have a lot of thoughts. I think about this every day. Truly, every day of my life, I think about this and what I want to say.
Listen to the most dramatic podcast ever with Chris Harrison on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Lance Bass, host of the new iHeart podcast, Frosted Tips with Lance Bass. The hardest thing can be knowing who to turn to when questions arise or times get tough or you're at the end of the road.
Okay, I see what you're doing.
Do you ever think to yourself, what advice would Lance Bass and my favorite boy bands give me in this situation? If you do, you've come to the right place because I'm here to help. This I promise you.
Oh, God.
Seriously, I swear. And you won't have to send an SOS because I'll be there for you.
Oh, man.
And so my husband, Michael.
Hey, that's me.
Yep, we know that, Michael. And a different hot, sexy teen crush boy bander each week to guide you through life step by step.
Oh, not another one.
Mm-hmm. Kids, relationships, life in general can get messy. You may be thinking, this is the story of my life.
Oh, just stop now.
If so, tell everybody, yeah, everybody, about my new podcast and make sure to listen so we'll never, ever have to say bye-bye-bye. Listen to Frosted Tips with Lance Bass on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Even though his relationship with Charlo was strained, Brandon's grandma Bonnie never let him down.
About every 3 months, we'd travel down to see him, and we'd spend the night and go early the next morning, and we'd get to stay 4 hours with him and sit across the table from him. He never gave up, and he always claimed his innocence, and I knew he was innocent. And he lifts me up. He's the type of person that lifts you up and makes you feel better about yourself. He's not a person that's down all the time.
She's like my angel. She's like my rock. I tell people that all the time. I'm like, that's my angel right there. I mean, she's never once even like faltered from the truth. She's been like, there's no way. Absolutely. I believe in you. She doesn't care who she has to stand up and tell that to, including the investigators. She's like, you know, show me proof. Like, quit telling me y'all have proof. Show me something.
With Bonnie by his side, Brandon spent years in prison appealing his decision to no avail. But while he stayed upbeat in front of his grandmother, inside, his emotions were a different story. Prison is a hard place for anyone, especially a young man finding himself.
You gotta have walls put up anyway. You gotta be like a different person in here. You can't be, you know, to cry, you're weak, or to be gay, you're a little bit weaker, or so you always have to kind of like prove yourself. So I just stay out of really everybody's way. I don't really even talk to too many people here.
Brandon spends much of his time in prison taking classes or working in the craft shop.
Are you wearing a wedding ring?
Actually, I made this in the craft shop.
Oh, you did?
So yeah. I started working with like metal and stuff like that.
Okay.
We're allowed like a few, what they call in prison free world items. So you can have a wedding band, a watch, and then you can have like a cross necklace.
And it can only be a wedding ring?
Yeah, you cannot have any other rings or jewelry, or that's considered contraband.
There are certain red flags that we look for in every single case. Brandon exhibits a lot of them.
In 2021, Allison Clayton from the Innocence Project of Texas took on Brandon's case.
First red flag, you don't know anything about the victims. That is, a good investigation will always start out with, who are these victims? Why did they meet this horrific end, right? A good investigation that's bent on figuring out what happened to these people and not bent on painting a bullseye around someone, like you've already chosen who did it. A good investigation starts with the victims.
So who were Norma and Dennis?
They weren't judgmental. They weren't, you know, my mom volunteered for adults and children that really a lot of the world wouldn't have nothing to do with them because they can't come sit at a dinner table, you know, normally and functionally. And I mean, my dad used to go to these drag shows for guys that would dress up like Dolly Parton and Tina Turner, like the Fab Five, you know? And so like, I feel really, really bad that the jury didn't get to learn about who my parents were. Like, they did not humanize my parents because they would know that my dad's best friend from high school and college is openly gay. They're basically not only accusing me of killing my parents because I was gay and had a lifestyle, but they're also accusing my parents of being so judgmental that they wouldn't have loved their son if he was gay. You're telling me that my parents are basically like hateful people.
In fact, at trial, Brandon's lawyers presented that Brandon's dad did know about Brandon's sexuality. It wasn't a secret from him. On the evening of the 16th, the night the Woodruffs were presumably murdered, Dennis spoke on the phone with his sister, Kathy.
During that phone call is whenever Dennis told his sister, you know, Brandon told me that he likes boys. And he told his sister, you know, he was okay with it, that he loved Brandon. And he's fine with it. It's just he was worried about Brandon because that can be a dangerous lifestyle. So this entire idea that his parents would have rejected him because of his sexuality, there is no basis in fact for that.
Allison goes on to outline a key part of Brandon's defense at trial, his alibi. We know Brandon was out of his parents' house a bit after 7 p.m. because cell phone records show he called them at 7:36 p.m., indicating he had already left the house. But after that,
Brandon wasn't really with anybody after the time he left his parents' house until much later that night when he met up with his friend back in Dallas. So it's not like we have somebody who can say, yes, he was with me, this is what we were doing. So in those instances, normally we would go back to the cell phone records.
But remember, there were missing records during the crucial time because of the cell phone company merger. So Brandon's team relied on piecing together other people's records, people who he said he was on the phone with. Allison says this timeline is the most important part of the case.
The first time in Brandon's phone records that we have really anything is whenever we have that ping at 10:46, where he's around I-30 and 635.
This intersection is about 20 minutes away from both of Brandon's parents' homes. A neighbor had seen Brandon down at the Heath house just after 10 p.m.
He would have been about 20 minutes away from them at 10:46, which means he would have left from either Roy City or Heath at around 10:26 that night.
And Norma spoke to her mother on the phone that night as well.
If the last time that anyone spoke to the Woodruffs was that call between Norma and her mom from 9 to 9:20, then you look at everything else. In my analysis, I look at everything from 9:20 that evening until 10:26.
Leaving Brandon with just an hour where he could have killed his parents. But the timeline shrinks even more.
During that time, you've got the call at 9:27 from Brandon to Alex, 9:32 to Morgan, 9:41 with Morgan, 9:49 with the roommate he was taking back, 10:10 to Morgan. And then that's that. So you've got five phone calls during that hour. And between those phone calls, I'm terrible with math, but it's looking to me like, I mean, there's about maybe 10, 11 minutes tops that you have in between any of these phone calls.
Allison says that in such a short amount of time, it's unrealistic, if not impossible, that Brandon would have been able to pull all of this off. Shoot and stab both of his parents, shower, change his clothes and shoes, hide his clothes and shoes, clean the bathroom, clean the knife and gun, ditch the gun, and hide the knife.
A man who has zero history of violence. So either he is, just committing a vicious crime against his parents in really, really efficient style, which I've never seen anyone inflict the number of wounds that these people had on them in 10 minutes' time. Or you're assuming that he's in the course of murdering his parents, he gets a phone call from Morgan and, you know, hey, Morgan, how's it going? Everything's fine over here. What are you doing? Or, you know, you hang up and you go back to murdering your parents. And then your boyfriend calls you like, oh, hey, Alex, yep, I'm going to be there later on this evening. Yeah, I've just got to finish up here and we're going to go and we're going to party in Dallas all night long. And then you hang up and you keep on murdering your parents. Neither one of those scenarios makes sense to me.
So Allison has a different theory. It wasn't Brandon. And she says the crime scene points to that. Remember the air mattress, the women's pants, the porn, and the condoms?
I know for a fact that my dad has a bisectomy because he's actually told me that on multiple occasions. In fact, you know, he had told me so much it became a joke. And so I tell myself, like, why would you need a condom if you had a bisectomy?
And then the pornography collection? Why would you have a pornography collection out? There are some very overtly sexual elements that are a part of the crime scenes. I think there's definitely something going on there.
Not only that, but Norma was found with long blonde hairs in her hands. And those hairs were never tested for the original trial.
They did not test the hair in the dead woman's hand. Which is just befuddling to me. You know, if you're truly investigating, truly trying to find out who did this, what would you do? Like, you don't have to be an investigator. You don't have to have FBI training or anything advanced. What do? You test the hair in the dead woman's hands. But they didn't do that. So to this day, we don't know who that hair belongs to.
Since Allison and the Innocence Project of Texas have taken Brandon's case, they have actively fought for DNA testing of the hair and any other items that exist from the crime scene.
Is that evidence still available for us to go look at? I don't know. We filed requests with, you know, law enforcement, with the DA's office. We're trying to figure out, you know, where's the hair? What about everything else? I don't know where those things are at. I don't know if they have been maintained. They should have been, but I mean, come on, it's Texas. Just because it should have doesn't mean it happened.
While Brandon waits, he concentrates on the future he'll have when he's out.
You know, growing up, I've always wanted to adopt a kid. Like, I've even told, you know, my girlfriend at the time, I was like, hey, you know, if we ever have kids, like, I would rather have, like, one of my own and adopt one. In college, I was a part of the Big Brother, Little Brother program. And so that really opened my eyes to, you know, there's a lot of kids in, you know, a lot less fortunate places and situations. Now I look, you know, looking at myself now, I'm like, okay, you're 36. You might be 37 or 38 before something, you know, goes on with your case. And then at least for a couple years, I want to just hang out and spend time with the people who took care of me.
Especially his grandma, Bonnie.
My grandmother's like a very avid traveler. And I'm just like, Mimi, look, one day when I come home, we're not going to sit down. Like, I don't want to be idle. I've been idle for too long now.
But in thinking about all the people who were there for him, Brandon can't help but think about the people who weren't, like his sister, Charla.
You know, it's been over 10 years and I can still remember some of the things she said. And yet I still love my sister. So it's really a, you know, a torn feeling right there.
Brandon says that although his parents are gone, they're always with him. And that inspires him to keep going.
It's a lot more personal than what a lot of people think. People are thinking, oh, well, you know, the truth's going to come out one day. But there's, you know, there's not justice for me right now, but there's also not justice for my parents either. And so I told myself, you know, I'm going to make this count. Like, my parents need, you know, justice, but they also need, you know, some change in Texas. Something good can come from this. And maybe that can be like my parents' legacy is to help what needs to be fixed in the justice system. I don't want this to just be like, okay, well, he's innocent, he's free, and we're gonna let this go. I mean, I think there needs to be at least some change because this should never, ever, ever have happened to me, and it definitely shouldn't happen in the future.
To learn more about Brandon's case and show your support, visit freebrandon.org, and you can sign a petition for his exoneration at change.org. Next time on Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling, Deb Nichols.
You could see the emergency lights as we were coming up the street, and I got out of the car and started running around the corner, and it was my house, and it was on fire, and I was literally terrified, and my brain was like, I need to get to the back and make sure the kids are okay.
Thanks for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in our bio to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom and Kevin Wirtis, as well as our senior producer, Annie Chelsea, producer Lila Robinson, and story editor Sonia Paul. The show is edited and mixed by Annie Chelsea, with additional production by Jeff Clyburn and Connor Hall. The music in this production is by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all three platforms. You can also follow me on both Instagram and Twitter at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company Number One.
People who don't know Bruce have to understand two things. One is he's built like something Michelangelo has carved out of a piece of marble.
True, this is true.
And number two, he's the first person to show you that at every party, at every dinner.
Maybe take a shirt off.
I'm Bruce Bozzi. That was George and Julia. You may not know me yet, but you already know most of my lunch dates by their first names and voices alone. Listen to Table for Two on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Langston Kermit. Sometimes I'm on TV.
I'm David Bory, and I'm probably on TV right now.
David and I are going to take a deep dive every week into the most exciting, groundbreaking, and sometimes problematic Black conspiracy theories. We've had amazing past notable guests like Brandon Kyle Goodman, Sam J. Quinta Brunson, and so many more.
New episodes are out every Tuesday, mini episodes out on Thursdays, where we answer you, the listeners, conspiracy theories.
Listen to My Mama Told Me on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the podcast, Howler Back Now with Holland Roden, take a trip back to Beacon Hills for the ultimate Teen Wolf rewatch with the cast and crew.
Because as if 100 episodes wasn't enough, I am bringing you all the behind the scenes. There's going to be so much more from each episode. Nothing is off limits. And, oh, that's right. We'll be talking about Teen Wolf, the movie.
Listen to Howler Back Now with Holland Roden on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.